Hi everyone, welcome to the third episode of Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation, which is not a continuation of the second episode in which I discuss the early history of punctuation. So this is not the history of punctuation in the West part two, but a little interlude on the shape of punctuation marks. Why do they look like the way they do? Called The Shape of Them. Which is a very thinly veiled allusion to the Ed Sheeran song, which, to my shame, I like a lot. It's a great party song for a time when we can have parties again, which will come, I suppose. So, I want to talk a little bit about why the marks have the shape that they do, and also about how we deal with it today. So are we being super inventive and coming up with new things, or are we repurposing what we already have, and so on. So at first I thought, what actually makes the good punctuation mark, so to speak? And I suppose one thing is that it really needs to be unsimilar to letters, so as not to be mixed up with the letters around it. So it needs to be quite distinct and have its own value, rather than, it needs to be a symbol, right? So we can give it its own value so that we don't mix it up with any letters before or after. So it just needs to look different from the letters of the alphabet. And I suppose it also needs to be simple enough in shape to not take much time, because punctuation, part of its raison d'être, as it were, is to make reading faster and easier. And if you spend a lot of time deciphering the punctuation mark because it's maybe very decorative or something, that would defeat its purpose, of course. So it's just got to be kind of simple, something that you can jot down in like a nanosecond or whatever. And another thought was that it needs to be easily shaped by the hand. If you have a pen or a quill in your hand and you shape the mark, and also you need to be able to cut it, at least in the Renaissance, during the coming up of the printing press. You can't have something super complicated and then the typecutter isn't able to cut it and to produce it. Or it might break very often if it's very delicate. So nowadays it's a little bit different, of course, with the computers. Anything goes, I suppose. But back in the days when things were, well, not really back in the days, until quite recently, things had to be able to be produced on a big scale relatively easily. If you have an edging or a woodcut or something, fine, you know, that's a bit more of a specialized image or phenomenon or something. But something like a punctuation mark that you keep using again and again, you don't want it to break very quickly as a printer. So these three things I thought were some preliminary ideas on what a good punctuation mark needs. It has to be not similar to the surrounding letters. It has to have a relatively simple shape that you can make easily and that your eye can catch easily. And it has to be robust, let's say, in the production. Or, you know, you got to be able to shape it quite quickly by hand, or as a typeface, to be able to set it easily. Now, in classical times, for you who didn't listen to maybe the history of punctuation part one, in classical times, during the times of the Greeks and the Romans, they would write in something called scriptio continua, so just capital letters in one long line, in one long sequence. So they didn't really have a lot of blank space or a lot of features of layout of the page or of the text, rather, to mark sections. So in the late classical times and the early Middle Ages, writers would inherit this practice of scriptio continua, which is not to have any space between letters, words, sentences. And when you get this, then of course, how are you gonna insert anything if there's no space to insert anything? Even if you wanted to, even if you, you know, some kind of revelation, and you have, let's say, somebody in 200 AD gets from some punctuation god all the punctuation marks that we use today, where are they going to insert them if there's no space? So it's not a surprise that the first punctuation marks were dots that were squeezed in between the letters, and they had different, they indicated different levels of pause depending on where they were in the line in relation to the letters. So that kind of changed in the course of a couple of hundreds of years, but by the 6th-7th century you had a dot at the bottom to indicate a long pause that would become our full stop after a complete sentence. You had a dot in the middle to indicate a medial pause that would become the colon, and then a dot on top. In antiquity, sort of 100, the first century before Christ, it was sort of the opposite, that the longest pause would be a dot on top of the line. But that really doesn't matter for now. That's kind of irrelevant. But what is relevant is that people would squeeze dots between the letters, because that's the thing that there was space for, right? So that's not really a surprise. But the problem is that since those dots were, their value depended on where they were on the line, and also their relation to the letters, that kind of opened up a lot of possibility, a lot of opportunities for ambiguity, I suppose, because the habit of one writer might be to put the medial dot always a little bit lower, and the other would put it a little bit higher. So these kind of rules were not super hard and fast, and a lot depended on the habit of the scribe or the shape of the letters, and maybe a couple of letters would be would put in capital for other reasons of decoration or practice or habit or custom or whatever kind of indication. So the dots might migrate and then take on different values, and it would make reading a little bit confusing perhaps. But anyway, the dots, the you know, the first punctuation that we sort of have, or like Latin and Greek have, is dots between the letters, because that was the only thing that there was space for. And then as time goes by, other kind of shapes are being invented. For instance, something a little bit looking like a seven, where the head hovers above the line, and the sort of the body of the seven goes into the writing between two letters. And that also makes a lot of sense, because you have this very thin line squeezing in between the two letters, and then using the top of the line where there's a little bit of blank space from between the lines, from one line to another. So again, you know, people make do with the space that they do have, which is hardly any, and they start to use different environments and squeeze things in. For example, there's also the virgule, which would then become the virgule in French, that's still called the comma, and that's been around for a very long time, at the same time as the shape of the comma that we have today. So people used two things at the same time, also in printing. And that's just a forward slash. Again, something that you can add quite quickly and easily between the letters. At some point in the, what was it, I think, 8th century as well, people, being Irish monks, started to insert blank spaces between words. And they did that because they were parsing the Latin. So they were trying to find out the different cases of the Latin that they were copying, the scriptures or the church fathers or other theological texts. And in order to not make mistakes with these and to know where a word started and another finished, they inserted spaces between the letters. And once you have those spaces, I mean, anything's possible, right? And that is also why new punctuation marks come up, although quite late, actually, in the sort of 14th, 15th century. And I think I'm going to share some thoughts on why punctuation sort of stalled a little bit in the Middle Ages, or so-called Middle Ages. Maybe I'll explore that more later, but some scholars think that monks, who were the primary text producers at the time, didn't want writing to be easy because they sort of developed an elite caste of people, or not maybe monks, but churchmen, let's say. And they didn't want reading to be easy, or they just didn't need it because they were so good at Latin. But then you have these Irish monks who insert spaces so that they can know when a word, the boundaries of a word. So apparently there was a need, and there wasn't exactly a very, very high level of Latin like there was in classical times. But I mean, to read Latin without any punctuation at all is a huge skill, I would imagine. And maybe one needs to be a bit kinder when one says the knowledge of Latin declined after the Romans and so on. But I think it is worthwhile to wonder why there were only three dots at different levels of the line for such a very, very long time, sort of between the 6th century and the 14th century. I suppose it does, it is worthwhile to ask that. But just to continue, so once we have space between the words, new shapes can emerge, and did. For example, the question mark and the exclamation mark. And just to go with the exclamation mark for now, one history I have read is that it sort of came up in the at first in around 1400 in the manuscripts of Jacopo al Pollaio, and so an Italian scholar, and the shape of the exclamation mark was sort of a long stroke hovering above a circle, a little circle, so not yet a dot, as it were. And some scholars say that shape came about from EO, so E and O, so like a long stroke and an O, a kind of circle, written on top of each other, coming from the Latin EO for hurrah. So I suppose when you use an exclamation mark, you kind of shout hurrah and you express joy. I mean, we also express anger and other kinds of emphasis with that, but maybe that sort of came later. So these spaces allowed now for different kinds of shapes and different kinds of feeling, I suppose, added to the text, because exclamation mark and question mark add intonation, add feeling, add information on how something is being read or is being said, rather than what is being said, which is what I suppose dots would be mainly working towards. And I found that really interesting that the EO, the exclamation mark, probably comes from two letters being written on top of each other, because when the first typewriters were being invented in the 1860s in the US, they only had a limited amount of space, actually, on their keyboard. And the history of QWERTY is a whole different, I guess, podcast. Super interesting. But they didn't yet have
all the sort of keys that we have today. And the exclamation mark was missing. But of course, people still wanted to use an exclamation mark in their writing. So what they did was to put an apostrophe, which at that time, I suppose, you know, depends on the shape, I guess, just a long a sort of stroke, like the I, as I said, on the EU. So like they would put an apostrophe and then they would go back and put a dot underneath the apostrophe, as if they were superimposing it. But because the apostrophe hovers on the top part of the line and the dot is just set at the bottom, they wouldn't be superimposed visually, but they were superimposed in the action, as it were. And this didn't change for quite a while. I read that up until the 1960s and 80s, 100 years after the invention of the typewriters or the development, some typewriters still didn't have an exclamation mark. So people had to manually manipulate the writing and go back and forth and break open that linearity, which I really loved thinking about, because, you know, you do something to that writing. It's a very mechanical, or, you know, you have this machine now and you don't just press a button, you can do something to it. Now we have everything nowadays. It's all easy. Not quite. I think I will come to that a little bit later, probably. So what I like in this typewriter sort of anecdote is that the shape of the punctuation is not just connected to the writing itself, what we think of the writing and what we're doing with it, but also the technology. And how does that find application in literature? For example, Emily Dickinson is, of course, super famous for her use of the dash. Dashes of various length, dashes at different levels of the line in her manuscripts. And so when there were the first editions of her work, I mean, the very first editions, I think just 2 years after her death by her sister-in-law, I believe, were super edited. So that wasn't actually what she was writing at all. And, you know, taking out the dashes, and dashes were not proper, and so on. And then in the next editions, that kept happening. Perhaps, I think they were a little bit more accurate, but it was still not working from the actual manuscript. And then only in the 1950s was there an edition of her work from the typed or transcribed from the original manuscripts with all the dashes. The problem, however, was that, of course, in the 50s, the edition was kind of transcribed onto a typewriter, where you only have a certain shape of the punctuation mark. So an N dash or an M dash. An N dash being the length of an N, and the M dash the length of an M. So just two options, and in the middle of the line, not a little bit on top or a little bit to the bottom. And, you know, technically we can say it doesn't matter, it's a dash. But with Emily Dickinson, who is the trademark writer of the dash, perhaps it does matter. And then in the 80s, there was the first facsimile of her manuscripts, a photo of her handwriting. And then you can really see what she's doing with the dashes. And perhaps it doesn't matter, perhaps it matters. I guess it depends on how we approach a text and what we kind of think of it and want of it and think of the author and so on, and think about what matters. But this is just a little digression, as it were, to think about the technology, technological aspect, and the possibilities, but also the limits of it. I suppose we think about technology as offering us limitless ways of representation, whereas actually that might not necessarily be the case. Now, going back to technology and shapes, but just going back a little bit in time, so we have the exclamation mark being invented sort of in 1400, and then also, of course, the brackets, which is my main theme. That's why I love talking about brackets. And in 1399, the Italian humanist Coluccio Salutati shows the first evidence of brackets. And that was a treatise on the nobility, which discipline is more noble, the law or medicine. And that was kind of a thing that they used to do. I think he was replying to another scholar, and he was defending law and the other scholar was defending medicine. And so they were sort of going back and forth publicly, as it were. So he dictated to his amanuensis, his secretary, and then he himself goes back and he adds punctuation. And he adds also brackets. And they were a little bit pointy at the time. And so that was the first manuscript use, the first manuscript evidence of brackets, of trying to parcel something off in a typographical sign or in a punctuation mark. Of course, before that, people were digressing in a sentence, they were digressing in a story, and that was called parentheses, but there was no sign to represent that. Now there was a sign to represent that little digression in a sentence, that little adding that doesn't necessarily need to be there syntax-wise or grammar-wise. If you take it out, this, the sentence should still hold as a grammatical unit. But the brackets were really, Salutati's brackets really didn't spread very far. I think I read about a single use of them in the entirety of the 15th century. However, for some reason or other, those manuscripts went to Germany of the second part of the 15th century, where you had printers like Johannes Fust, who introduced those brackets, and suddenly they became round. I don't think there's a, maybe there is a person who used the round brackets in Italian, whose name I have forgotten, who had those round brackets, but they really only took off because those early German printers used them and spread them thereby. And I think another reason might have been because Erasmus, the scholar, that Renaissance scholar, super famous, like, I don't know, maybe Zizek nowadays or something. He was mostly working in Basel, so in sort of a South German, Swiss region, and working together with his friend printer, Fröben, I think. And Erasmus wrote about the bracket in his writing when he was recommending, you know, certain kinds of style and grace in terms of writing. And he didn't yet say, he said they look like, brackets look like lunulae. He called them lunulae, little moons. So, you know, you have those round half circle moons. But he didn't use brackets yet in his writing, only in an edited, revised version of the same text 20 years later in the 1530s, did he actually say, this is what they look like, round brackets. But he already called them lunulae, so he already made a suggestion as to their shape, round little moons. And so that that technological aspect, that aspect that Erasmus is talking about them and that later comes to use them, allows the widespread of brackets and of round brackets. So again, we have technology really coming in decisively and pushing one thing rather than another, as it were. So the shape, again, I guess, is, you know, a round bracket or a bracket is very much not a letter. And it's easy to do. And you just have to remember to also close it and open and close what you, you know, you close the door that you open, right? So, but it is still relatively easy and easy to do and easy to shape and to produce. But again, technology is the responsible for spreading it. And I guess the thing that I also like in that bracket history, which is similar to the ellipsis history, which is the dot 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 of suspense, is that things were still very much moving and evolving, and stuff had different shapes, and you had the comma and the virgule being used at the same time. So it's, you know, lots of speed, lots of things going in parallel. And with the ellipses, the dot, 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 at the beginning, in the late 16th century, when people started to use them, they were actually hyphen, hyphen, hyphen. So you have short, like smaller than the dash, the hyphen, hyphen, hyphen next to each other, which then kind of migrated down to the bottom and became dot, dot, dot. They mean the same and at the time, but they slightly change for whatever reason. Same with the brackets. They used to be a bit pointy and then they became round, maybe to make them more distinct. Maybe there was another Latin abbreviation or something like that that looked similar, so they had to be made more distinct. So there's a lot of reasons why shapes change a little bit, sometimes very practical ones, sometimes more of an organic use, sometimes it's a single printer, a single person that decides that, and that somehow then gets spread and people start to pick up on it. And I think another important thing to say in terms of Renaissance as well, Lucullus Salutati, who sort of invents something because somehow he feels that there's a need, that he needs to mark that digression, that little sentence digression, as something else. Aldus Manutius, the Italian printer, superstar of the Renaissance printer that I will talk about in my second part of the history of punctuation, he invented the semicolon. So I don't want to speak too much about this just now, but like Salutati, there was a need for another punctuation mark. And so he was like, okay, what do? We just squash two together, the colon and the comma, and then you have a semicolon. So sometimes the shape would just, you know, be show a repurposing of what we already have anyway. And the last sign I want to talk about is the interrobang, which is exactly that, a repurposing of what we already have. And it's a punctuation mark that most of us will not be familiar with, but it marks rhetorical questions. So you have a exclamation mark and a question mark superimposed, so on top of each other. It's called interrobang. Which, you know, it's about an interrogation and it's a bang because, you know, you put a rhetorical question, right? And so the man who suggested that, again, a single person having a single idea, an individual idea, and suggesting that rather than it to be a sort of diffuse kind of development in general and writing, oh, here's something we need. Here is somebody who proposes something, who sees a need, or who, you know, wants to introduce novelty in writing or something. I suppose this guy really did see a need. He was called Martin Spector, and he was an advertising agent in the 1960s. And he felt that in advertising especially, you know, of course you need to be brief. Again, you know, what makes a good punctuation mark? It's got to be brief. You don't have time to, you know, have this decorative thing. You need to catch it in one eye. It needs to make sense. And he thought that the incredibility of modern life, that's a quotation. He thought that the interrobang is an expression of the incredibility of modern life. It fits the times and comes none too soon when there's a new crisis or calamity almost every day. Now, this is the 1960s, and I mean, every generation says, you know, that they live in crisis, right? But that incredulity, I suppose, of maybe the bipolar world just coming out of the Second World War, or lots of change, women's rights, whatever, is perhaps captured in this bang and question mark. Rhetorical question. And Martin Spector wrote to a advertising magazine. I was surprised that it exists. There's people in advertising who read that, but each to their own. He wrote in a little article in an advertising magazine, so for people who advertised, asking other readers, other subscribers to send in their shapes. He said, okay, I think we need this new mark, which is really just a mark repurposing old stuff, to mark a rhetorical question. What kind of shape do you think it should have? And people came up with different kinds of things, also the name, but they eventually settled on the quotation mark, exclamation mark, superimposed. And interestingly, that mark, the entire bank, is still around. You can still use it in certain typefaces because there's a Unicode for it. And again, that's the technological aspect that comes in, because in the 1960s, I think it's called American Association, and then I can't remember, sorry. But that was an association that tried to come up with codes, computer codes, on letters, punctuation mark, spaces, anything, to have that unified. So, and today that still exists, and it's called Unicode, and it's a huge, incredibly powerful association to synchronize phones. So sometimes, for example, phones or like digital communication, because sometimes I used to have an old phone and then I would send a smiley and somebody else received it as this alien face or something, or like a ghost or whatever. So in the early, I think in the 90s, in the early days of texting and stuff, those systems were not yet unified, but now we have Unicode, and that's why when you now send a unicorn, it's actually arriving as a unicorn in this other system, Android, iPhone, whatever. And that's Unicode. Also emoji, for instance, they need to authorize and make code for emoji. And because of the virus, this year there's not going to be a new set of emoji, sadly, because they didn't manage to meet. So we emoji users have to wait until next year to have all those different new emojis or emoji. So, yes, I think that's sort of it, I suppose, a little whistle stop tour through some shapes of punctuation or some thoughts on the shape and how did the shape come to be. I suppose it was very often for practical reasons. You know, what can I squeeze in? Once there was space between the words, there was a lot more possibility for adding emotion or adding new kinds of approaches to the syntax or the text, as it were, new kinds of ways to mark something, but very much based on practical considerations. Sometimes actual interventions by people who propose certain shapes. A lot of it is based on technology. What do the technologies of writing allow us actually to do? And I think that's sort of it. That's my thinking for the moment. Perhaps as I go on, I'll find some new reasons why stuff is shaped the way it is. If you have any ideas, let me know. I would love to hear from that. And I guess I will now leave you with the easiest shape, which is the blank space.